Hello and welcome to Gascast Season 3, Episode 3. And joining me at 8 o'clock on a Friday night are fellow sad clowns Mark Salmon.
Hello.
Rebecca Smith.
Hi.
And Frank Schneider.
Hello.
So, good evening, everyone. Quick opening poll. Boring lives or unbeatable dedication to critical care research and anesthesia podcasting?
Boring lives.
Yeah, boring.
It is pretty sad that no one seems to have anything better to do on a Friday night. Mark and Frank, you've obviously got reasonable excuses.
We're housebound anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
You're both housebound. I'm going to say I'm on call tomorrow. And Rebecca?
I'm not going to tell you the truth. So I'm going to say lack of other options, which just makes me sound even worse.
Bex is kind of housebound.
Yeah. Kind of housebound in a...
Let's move on to the introductions.
So, yes, good evening, everybody. So you guys all know, and for those of you who may have seen what was been going on in the past when you listened to this podcast, but we're trying to revive our Gascast Twitter account. We've got a reasonable number of followers, but virtually no tweets. So we apologise for that. I think it's probably a bandwidth issue. I don't think any of us are particularly good or any good at tweeting. But I certainly struggle trying to use multiple accounts. I think Mark probably does, and Bex, you're kind of struggling to use any account at the moment, aren't you?
Yes, I've opted out for now.
So I think probably what we're going to do is keep the account running for a bit longer, but then sort of gradually close it down, and we'll put our own Twitter accounts onto the website. So you can transfer over if you want to follow us, and we'll try and get better at tweeting because it is going to be the communication form for free and open access medical education in the next coming years. So I'm at Rick Thomas. Frank, you are at CritCare Annas. What's the best way to say that? At CritCare _ Annas? A-N-E-A-N-E-S?
A-N-A-E-S, yeah. Sorry, not the... Not the easiest.
Not the easiest one.
I'm still a bit upset you actually managed to get Rick Thomas. Obviously at the forefront of Twitter subscribers.
That, and it's the wisdom of spelling Rick in a funny way that stops me getting confused with the Las Vegas magician, Rick Thomas. Bex, you are Gascast _ Bex, and you'll
Thank
be
you.
Activating and doing your first tweet as soon as you manage to remember what your password is. And Mark, you are Seb Chumpipe, or Seb _ Chumpipe.
Yep.
And why would that be?
It seemed like a funny name at the time, and so I use it for all sorts of online accounts.
You must have other alter egos as well, then. Are they along the same lines?
Yeah, I tend to stick with a very narrow repertoire. No, Seb Chumpipe's all over the place. Seb Chumpipe's quite prolific on the PlayStation Network.
Is that who you play poker?
Yeah. Yes, Sebastian Chumpipe has been known to do some late night gambling.
Is he kind of like your bad alter ego, your medical Slim Shady?
Exactly.
Nice. So there we go. Also, did you guys appreciate the? Can you hear the fireworks in the background from my recording?
Yeah, a little bit.
I've got some myself.
Oh, have you? Okay, so this is going to be sound effects on this episode. Did you guys did you appreciate the mega notes on the last episode?
What on the?
There was
on the
one that sounded definitely like a fart, but.
Oh no no no! I'm going to come to that later.
Oh,
about.
Sorry.
No. If you remember on the on the podcast notes, which I do. And no one ever reads. Well, I think no one ever reads, because we've got an expanded news section now. It's turned into sort of quite thick mega notes, because we're covering more stuff. So if you're listening and anything that piques your interest, it should appear on the new mega notes for the new format podcast. So have a look at the website. And finally, it is Friday night. I'm quite amped up on KFC and Starbucks, but Mark, you've had a bit of a tragic afternoon, haven't you?
I can't talk at all. I've had a load of tramadol, basically, is what's happened.
What, recreationally or
not for fun?
No, I think I've broken a metatarsal in my right foot. Which is pretty painful.
Doing what?
Well, it's nothing really. This is the embarrassing thing. It was I got home from a night shift and was having a snooze on the sofa. when I heard knocking at the door. My wife was expecting a parcel, so I jumped up off the sofa without realizing that my leg had entirely gone to sleep and and was numb. And so just, I don't know what happened.
Collapsed.
Yeah, when I landed on that foot, I didn't fall over, but something gave way and I've been unable to walk on it ever since. So
you had it x-rayed?
No, I figure if it's getting, you know, not getting better tomorrow, I'll go and have a Saturday morning x-ray rather than a Friday night A&E visit. I figure there's not much to be done anyway, whether it's broken or not. But if I'm babbling tonight...
We'll just stop you and
blame the drums.
It's good stuff.
So, but basically, your injury you got from just getting off the sofa.
Yeah, which is fair enough, because that's about as sporty as I get.
Well, you know what the learning point is there, don't you?
Don't get off the sofa ever.
Stay there for your own safety. Great. So let's crack on with some news. And first up, I think, is Mark with the medical news.
Alrighty then. So I started off by looking at the BMJ, see what the news there is this week. And, I'm going to struggle with this, I think.
Is this because of the BMJ or because of the tramadol?
I think it's the tramadol. It kind of comes in waves. Yeah, I have to cut this out because I am wasted.
How much did you take? 100?
No, I only took 50. I thought I'd keep it mild because of recording this. But I guess deep breath.
You are not one of life's little soldiers, are you? You've fallen off the couch, broken your foot, and 50 milligrams of tramadol knocked you for 6.
Cheap date.
Yeah, well, and I did nights, and I've been on nights, so I'm kind of jet lagged as well.
Yeah.
But Rick, could you do someone else's section and I'll try and compose myself?
Okay. All right, so we'll come back to the medical news. What is the half-life of tramadol, anybody? Do we know?
It's a bit longer than the 45-minute podcast. 45-minute
podcast, all right. Well, let's give Mark a couple of seconds to try and recover. And Bex, why don't you do the anesthesia news?
Sure. So, I looked at the November issue of Anesthesia News, and, you know, it's a really great read. It's a really uplifting issue. It's so nice.
It was carrying 3 or 4 articles written by R. Smith.
No, it's
because Anesthesia News normally is.
There was a lot of focus on the Lifebox Foundation, which obviously, because we bought one of those, well, didn't we? We bought one of those pulse oximeters.
I want to know where ours is. I thought they were going to tell us where it ended up.
Yes, I need to follow up on that, and I shall do that.
Yeah,
but so yeah, we did. We did buy a Lifebox, a Gascast Lifebox, so it is somewhere. Yeah.
So just for those that haven't bought a Lifebox yet, and... and familiar with the charity. It's a charity that was established in 2011, and the point is to promote safe surgery in resource-poor countries. And what they're trying to do is introduce the WHO checklist and make sure that there's access to pulse oximeters during surgery. So if you're interested in raising money for the charity, what I didn't realise is the AAGBI have actually made a little fundraising pack, which you can download off their website, and you can hold a great anaesthesia bake-off in your department. And so far, they've raised £13,000. And then this article was followed up by another one about introducing the Lifebox into Kenya, where there's something unbelievably ridiculous, like 150 anaesthetists for 43 million people. So, yeah, it was a really heartwarming episode. It was a really, really heartwarming issue. Then I followed that with a bulletin. It was also a good one. This month's bulletin had a paediatric theme. So there was quite a few tips on anaesthetising anxious and agitated children. There was quite a good in-depth look at the future of paediatric surgery in non-specialist centres. And then there was advice on managing pain in paediatric day surgery. And I mean, I haven't anaesthetised anything smaller than about 1.5 metres. So it was a good refresher for me. Apart from that, I heard for the first time that NAP6 project is going to be anaphylaxis, and I was introduced to SNAPs. Now, Do all of you, have you heard of Snaps?
This is the short sprint national Olympics. Yeah. Yes, I have.
Yeah. So the first Snap is going to be done in 2014. And the aim of the Snap is to provide a snapshot of clinical activity in an area of interest, which is of clinical interest to patients. So I think initially they're just going to be service evaluations, but over the long term, the plan is to repeat them and they'll become part of a quality improvement audit. So SNAP 1 is going to be a one-week evaluation of patient-reported outcome after anaesthesia, especially focusing on patient satisfaction and patient-reported awareness. So it's slightly different from the normal NAPs because the SNAP data collection will be primarily by trainees. And then uploaded in a sort of similar fashion. So, yeah, it should be interesting. I don't know if anyone's volunteered to be part of the SNAP committee.
No, I haven't. Frank's not a trainee.
Oh, sorry, Frank, didn't mean to drag you down to
I do still feel a bit like a trainee. But they did, I think we've discussed it on this podcast, actually, because they did the, I think one of the first sort of sprint audits was the HIP network. Sprint audit that's just finished off and I think is going to be presented towards the end of the year. But yeah, I mean, it was the same sort of concept, but just looking at how people are anaesthetizing for hip fractures and outcomes for those patients. So I think it's just it's quite a topical way of auditing clinical activity.
Great. But that was what was in those two journals. Well, sorry, that was what was in those two magazines.
Perfect, Bex, thank you very much. And carrying on to Frank. Frank, education-wise, what have you got for us?
My first port of call was going to be the Continuing Education Journal, only to realise that we have got ahead of ourselves, so we don't actually have a new one to look at just yet. So I cheekily looked at the Advanced Access articles. So sorry if I steal someone else's for future podcasts. And I saw that friend of Gascast, Chaya Sharma, has written an article on paracetamol, mechanisms and updates.
So yes, well done, Chaya is a paracetamol expert.
Is she?
Yeah. It's a surprisingly interesting drug in that no one really knows how it works.
Yeah, I've got it. I read through it because Chaya wrote it. And it's very good sort of prep work for everything and anything you ever wanted to know about paracetamol, but it does spend a bit of time just looking at the mechanisms of action and what we know or think we know about it. And then what was most interesting to me was right at the end, she describes, or they write about a couple of novel uses. One of them was pre-induction IV paracetamol, which has been shown to prevent REMI-induced hyperalgesia. And then also using IV paracetamol haven't for a long time done IV regional anaesthetics, but if anyone out there is doing them, if you use IV paracetamol as part of your intravenous regional anaesthetic technique, it's apparently you get much better outcome as well. So better pain control, less tourniquet pain, and longer lasting anaesthesia. So thought there were interesting takes on uses of paracetamol I hadn't considered previously. Tying in with what Bex has spoken about already, so NAP6 has been announced as looking into anaphylaxis. And there's a good summary on anaesthesia-related anaphylaxis, so obviously mostly drugs that we would use, and the investigation of those episodes and follow-up. So that's a good summary read for anyone interested in that. I thought you guys might be interested, actually. There's an article, quite a balanced and I think quite well-written article on rapid sequence induction and its place in modern anaesthesia and sort of examining and in a way challenging some of the more traditional views. I mean, I think most of us have grown up in an era where we don't stick to a traditional didactic rapid sequence technique. And most of us probably modified what we do and tailor it more specifically to the specific patient situation. And really, that's what the article goes on about and how you do have to, the RSI was originally described back in the 70s and is probably not as relevant to the way we give anaesthetics today.
Where's that article, Frank?
That's it's Advanced Access, so it's available on the website. But obviously not in print just yet. But yeah, if you've got access to the Oxford or to the BJA and the Continuing Education Journal, you can get the PDF off the website.
And you can get it straight from the Mega Notes.
Yeah, and obviously we'll link to it from the Gascast website. So yeah, that was quite good. Then moving on to the AAGBI, the tutorial of the week is on, oddly enough, on hip fractures as well. And that ties in with what I was going to say about the sprint audit that was done on hip fractures recently. Again, it's just, as they usually are, just a good summary for anyone who's, I mean, I think we all probably anesthetize for these patients that form quite a large percentage of the trauma population that come in. So good summary for that if you want to refresh your knowledge on and it really focuses on why we shouldn't cancel them and what are sort of acceptable reasons for cancellation and not, and goes through the whole, you know, delaying surgery for unnecessary investigations and so on. And the take-home message would be that really the only things you should cancel or postpone for are hemoglobin less than 80, major electrolyte disturbances, so potassium less than 2.8 or greater than 6, or sodium that's less than 120 or greater than 150, uncontrolled diabetes or correctable cardiac rhythm disturbances, and reversal coagulopathy. And anyone who's interested in that kind of thing, and was also just going to mention two upcoming meetings that are generally very good. There's the Winter Scientific Meeting in early January, or mid-January, 15th to the 17th. And the Intensive Care Society State-of-the-Art Meeting, anyone who's interested in intensive care. I went last year and it was a really good meeting, lots of parallel sessions and lots of interesting things for anyone. And then lastly, from the education section, I was just going to point out, I don't know if any of you have seen, it is hot off the press from today's AAGBI email, but they've put together a really good looking website called Learn at AAGBI. The tagline's providing lifelong learning in anesthesia. And it's essentially just a collection of all the AAGBI videos and other content on one website. It's got really good search functionality, so you can search by categories or GMC domains or AAGBI conferences that have happened. And you can do a whole lot of learning modules for which they'll provide you with a certificate, so you can add it into your portfolio. And just looking at the website today, they've just got a sample of the content they've got. So they've got ITU papers that you should know about. They've got someone talking about tracheal transplants. They've got Simon Finney from the Brompton talking about the difficulty to ventilate patient. And these are all sort of video podcasts. Revalidation by someone, deputy chief executive from GMC. So lots of really useful resources if you're looking to do something and get certificates for and add to your portfolio for revalidation. And that's all I've got for education.
Brilliant. Those look, I'm just having a look at those now. Those look really, really good. I shall definitely try and incorporate some of those into my FICM revision, which is scaring the crap out of me at the moment. Fantastic. Thank you very much for that, Frank. That's great. So, Mark, how are you feeling? Are you feeling ready yet?
Yeah, I'm good.
can you see through the tramadol haze to tell us about the what's been in the medical press?
Let's give it a go.
Okie doke.
All right, so looking at some more general medical media coverage, I started out with the BMJ and a couple of articles that caught my attention. One was a news piece about the shortage of emergency department doctors. A watchdog committee has declared that this needs urgent action. And it just is quite interesting just because of it mentions some of the numbers there, such as that there are 5.3 million emergency admissions in England a year, which has gone up by nearly 50% over the last 10 or 15 years. So massive problem. It just made me wonder. They're talking in the article about looking at different ways of staffing emergency departments and bringing in more physicians and geriatricians to kind of pick people up from the door. And I wanted to ask you guys, would any of you fancy taking on an emergency role of any sort?
I wouldn't mind. We've got some on my ICU at the moment, we've got some Italian doctors who are coming over to do research fellowships, but working on our ICU. And they basically, from what I can gather, rotate around A&E, critical care, and anaesthesia. They seem to do a week of each, just basically bounce around on a three-week cycle, which seems a bit...
In Italy.
Yeah. Which seems a bit strange, but in fact, it's kind of what the ACCS, kind of critical care program, is in many ways about, or to give you a foundation in that. But yeah, I'd be up for it with supervision and support.
It's something I'm trying out at the moment. The place I'm working now has a major trauma consultant of the day for each 24-hour period, and 50% of those major trauma consultants on the rota are intensive care doctors, and the other 50% are emergency department doctors. And I think that's an interesting way we can cross over a bit between the departments and get involved really early. So that's something I'm going to be working on.
But there you've got a common skill set, because I mean, you really will just be looking at sort of major traumas and resuscitation, and, you know, obviously airways and things like that. So I think, so you're not going to be dealing with the dregs that are coming through to A&E departments, or, you know, be treating things that you're perhaps not that familiar with.
Well, that's the thing. Are you just put in recess in that situation? Because then you'll probably be okay. But, you know, if you show me an ankle X-ray, I'd have no chance.
No. The major trauma consultant just goes to the trauma courts.
Great. Well, that would be quite nice, actually.
And then in between, well, I'm not entirely sure yet, but they do some work with coding and the TARN data submission, so they kind of verify that the coding's all been done properly and look at the data. They go to a trauma meeting each day to talk about what's come in and what the short-term plans are for each of the patients. And then there's, you know, audit and X-ray meetings and all sorts. So there's lots of ways of getting involved. You're just doing the big trauma calls. You're not doing it, not doing routine emergency department work. But I guess that's what I'm getting at, is that that's the part of emergency that anaesthesia and critical care can help out in, if there is such a severe workflow shortage. I mean, this article says they're looking at only 50% of kind of job capacity, a 50% vacancy rate in trainee posts.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I ran into an anaesthetic registrar who's still locums as a kind of A&E middle grade, because there is such a shortage and it's quite well paid. But I know that I wouldn't be that comfortable doing it now, because I mean, if you're doing something like what you're describing, that's quite different, because, you know, that's something that you're probably used to and you've got skills for and so on. But yeah, I mean, I don't know that I'd be wanting to be stuck in majors or minors, God forbid.
No.
You know, looking at people who've drunk too much and fallen over, and
people who've got off their sofas too rapidly.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, moving on. Let's do a few more news articles. BMJ also had a quite interesting discussion about a legal decision relating to an ITU patient whose doctors had wanted to get a court order kind of allowing them to not proceed to filtration and inotropes and so on. And the original judge had said that there wasn't enough information and the guy might have some reversible things, and so he wouldn't give the court orders. Subsequently, a court of appeal disagreed with him, but said that was on maybe on the basis that the situation had changed in the intervening weeks. And then the reason it's in the news article now is that now the UK Supreme Court has ruled that the first judge was right. And basically what I take from this is it's just as confusing and scary as it ever was, if not more now, if the Supreme Court's saying that judges sometimes can't make these decisions, then it just makes it even more of a mystery as to the best way to proceed. But it's an interesting read, although it takes a few goings over when you've had strong painkillers. just to finish with the BMJ, some good news for fans of breast implants. The report following the scandal a couple of years ago of the French leaky breast implants has concluded that if they haven't burst yet, you don't need to have them removed. So good news for everybody there. moving to The Guardian this week, the BMJ itself was in the news because it's been announced that they have decided that any research, partly or fully funded by the tobacco industry, will not be published in the BMJ group journals. And they're by no means the first to do this. It's something that they've been talking about since the 90s, and lots of other people have already done, but it does raise an interesting debate about the general freedom of research. And although there are accusations of the tobacco industry tweaking their stuff, you know, a lot of people would say that all of this data should just be out there for everybody to look at and draw conclusions from. So, interesting debate on that.
Can I just ask, what research does the tobacco industry do? That sounds like this is probably a really naive question.
Well, so they'll be looking to... It says in the article that they promote a false evidence of doubt in the scientific consensus about the harms of tobacco. And what's becoming more interesting now is that you've probably seen people with the new generation of electronic cigarettes.
Yes.
Now, they are still in their very early days, and there's lots of research going on with them. I mean, we assume they're better than actual cigarettes, but they're not really been studied yet. However, the tobacco companies are buying up all of these electronic cigarette companies. And so if they're going to be the ones funding the research on these new products, the journals are already saying that because that's partly tobacco funded, they won't be publishing any of them. So that may inhibit us finding out more about the pros and cons of this kind of new nicotine replacement product, if you see what I mean. So yeah, it's interesting. Interesting debate. Somebody's typing furiously, you're trying to read up on this.
No. I'm tweeting.
Rick's tweeting.
Rick's tweeting. So I've been talking about this for a while, so let's just fire through the last few things I found. JAMA published a trial about the effect of statin therapy on mortality in patients with ventilator-associated pneumonia. There's been a lot of stuff going on recently about statins and sepsis, and a few big studies still pending. This one looked specifically at people with ventilator-acquired pneumonia, looking to whether a novel use of statin would reduce their 28-day mortality. But the study was stopped for futility at the first interim analysis, after they enrolled about 300, but they found no difference either way and didn't think it was worth carrying on. But as I say, there's a lot more work on this that's going to be coming out pretty soon. Right, let's skip through to, obviously you can't do a roundup of health news without checking out the Daily Mail health page.
Of course.
I knew you weren't going to disappoint us.
There's plenty to see there, but the good news of the day from the Daily Mail is that it turns out that eating loads of chocolate is the best way to lose weight.
Oh, let's hear a bit more about that. Yeah.
So Spanish researchers have looked at the diets and health activities of 1,500 teenagers and found that people who admitted eating large amounts of chocolates had, on average, far lower levels of fat over their bodies. And chocolate was also found to have a positive effect on circulation, blood pressure and heart health. They haven't fully referenced this article, so... I can't dig much deeper, but that's what they've got to offer. And that's the general health news.
Thanks.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. And you will be pleased to know, after last month, I have commissioned some Gascast intersection jingles and maybe a new theme tune. So I probably won't have them for this episode, but I will have them for the next one. So we've got that to look forward to, and no more abject silences or me trying to cover filler bits with this kind of rubbish, for which we'll all be greatly relieved. So that takes us on to our discoveries section, and I'll go first. I've got two discoveries. Oh no, that was one of my discoveries, that we're going to have some filler bits and some theme tunes, so get excited about that. Number two, I've actually nicked from somewhere else. It was another podcast, actually, but I think the Venn diagram of people who listen to this podcast, the intersection on the Venn diagram between people who listen to this podcast and people who listen to the one I've nicked this discovery from probably only consists of N equals one, and that's me. So I'm hoping not to get busted. So my discovery will be of interest to anyone who is like me and suffers from a paralyzing fear of sharks, which fortunately doesn't restrict my daily activities too much, although I do get slightly nervous in the bath. And I would suggest that Sharknado was a film that really did not need to be made. I found the clips for that on YouTube absolutely terrifying. But I have a distinct phobia of sharks, meaning I never swim in the sea. But I heard some research the other day when I was listening to this podcast, that says, using statistics, has shown that shark attacks actually save lives. And the reason for this, careful analysis of deaths in the ocean near San Diego shows that on average, the death of each swimmer killed by a shark saves the lives of 10 others. That's right. It's a number needed to treat of 10. And the reason for this is that for every time a swimmer is killed, the number of deaths by drowning goes down for a few years and then returns to a normal level. You know, they're picking off a few of the weak, but they're saving lives at a rate of numbers needed to treat 10, which is pretty good, actually. That's better, as I'll come on to talk about later, than low tidal volumes in ICU. So that's discovery number one. And in fact, I do have a discovery number two, which is I think the NSA have been listening to Gascast. I didn't see it in Edward Snowden's leaks, but every now and then I check on the number of Gascast downloads we have, really just to check that we've not gone so underground as to become completely irrelevant. And I was having a look at the number of downloads for last episode. For season 3, episode 1. And we'd hit a figure of 19,442, which did seem a lot. And I think that's more anaesthetists than in the UK and Britain. And that is a fairly significant anomaly for us. And it was all centered around a couple of days. And so I can only assume that it's the NSA trying to archive as much of Gascast as they can before the network connections to the US are all severed. And those are my discoveries. Terribly useful. Mark, have you got anything that will be more useful for people who are actually doing some anaesthesia?
Mine's very specifically more useful for Bex.
It's not another watch, is it? Another digital watch?
I've found some research that I think was probably inspired by somebody listening to you on previous Gascasts. it is an article in the Journal of Sexual Medicine.
Oh my goodness.
Entitled "The Bar Sinister Does Handlebar Level Damage the Pelvic Floor in Female Cyclists?" And they've done a study based on the fact that previous research suggests that saddle design and saddle pressures are associated with neurovascular compromise, particularly causing decreased genital sensation in women cyclists. So they've come up with an ingenious study where they've not only put probes all over the place and measured saddle to genital interface pressures, but they've also used vibratory sensory analyzing in various places over the perineum to quantify sensation. And it basically, to cut a long story short, if you put your handlebars lower than your saddle, you've got a much higher rate of genital numbness.
Oh, well, thank you for the tip. I'm cycling through Vietnam in January, and I'll make sure my handlebars are so high above my seat I can hardly reach them.
You're welcome.
That sounds like a trial you should have been recruited for, Bex.
Yeah, thank you.
You've got to read the methods, though. It sounds like a lot of fun.
Is there sufficient equipoise on this particular point to get it through ethics? That's what I want to know.
There is a surprising body of work in this area that I've discovered this afternoon.
Fair enough, and links to all of this will be in the mega notes. Bex, how are you going to respond to that discovery? You must have something helpful and potentially genital related for us.
You know, unsurprisingly, I don't. I'm going with something very just very pure and very anesthesia orientated. And I found it when I was reading the anesthesia news. It's the technique required to do CPR on patients in the prone position. So I'm afraid it's very bland compared to Mark's. But providing you have the airway sorted, apparently CPR can be done very effectively when you're in the prone position. And what you need is you need sternal counterpressure, which I hadn't heard about before. And what you need to do is slide a bag of saline underneath the sternum. And then you use the line through T6 as your compression point. And the purpose of the sternal compression is to compress both ventricles, so you promote forward flow into the relevant circulations, and then also to reduce the intrathoracic volume, so you get better defibrillation. And yeah, it was good to know. I have heard that you could do CPR in a prone position, but I always thought it was, you know, just it was substandard and just, you know, really quickly while you got the patient over on into the supine position. So now we know. But very straight.
Have you all had some tremors on that?
But how often?
No, I was just trying to figure out
why would you need to do?
And if you sorted out the airway, you probably would have been supine or at least
You imagine this: your patient is having spinal surgery. You know, they're prone, their whole back is open, and this has happened at an institution where I've worked, and they have arrested. And then, you know, what have you got? You've got a huge open wound. You need to turn the patient around. They're sort of strapped. You need loads of people. You know, obviously, the airway is really sorted. You're giving an anaesthetic. If you cavalierly put someone upside down with a Cadellan, you're in trouble. So presumably, you would have your airway sorted out.
I see what you mean. You're talking about intraoperative.
Totally. Arrest. Oh, sorry, I don't mean like someone just collapses on the floor and you can't be bothered to turn them over.
Yeah, someone's trapped in a prone position and...
No, I mean during anaesthesia. Sorry, I should have been more specific.
Yeah.
Yes, that would definitely have helped for clarification there.
No. I'm on board with you now, Bex.
Before it did just seem lazy. So just stand on top of their back and jump up and down for a bit. See what happens. Fantastic. And finally, Frank.
I've got one quick discovery. And no, Gascast isn't sponsored by Sonosite, but of course we are big fans of the Sonosite promotional videos. And I just happened to see that they've actually got a new bit of kit out. It's called the X-Port. And it promises much better ultrasound resolution and technology, of course. But it also has, apparently it's got a whole lot of sort of tutorial videos that you can run at the same time as your needling, should you need a refreshing of your technique or the anatomy. I haven't seen one live yet, but I was just looking at the website. But it does look like it's just a kind of a standalone unit, the usual sort of touch screen now with sort of multi-gesture functionality as well. And on one side, you've got the ultrasound picture. And in one part of the screen, you can then run tutorial videos going through. And anyone who's familiar with the Sonosite website and the instructional videos on various uses, so going from regional nerve blocks to vascular access and so on. So that's all incorporated into the machine. And the idea, I think, is that irrespective of your level of experience, you can go through the videos, you know, teach yourself or improve your technique or knowledge on particular blocks by just looking through the machine. So that looks pretty good. And then the main discovery I had was that for any of you who have a bugbear of sort of tangled leads and lines whenever you're transferring, especially, you know, sick patients with lots of bits of tubing in them and infusion pumps and so on, to ITU or transferring from a bed to CT and so on. Although there's not much we can do about the lines, perhaps, it looks like there is hope for monitoring leads and cables. And I had always wondered, really, although I suppose I've made up my own reasons, why we don't use things like Bluetooth for transmission of data and do away with a lot of the leads we have. And it seems that someone has started developing it now. So I went to a conference a couple of months ago, and there was an anaesthetist from Sydney, and you guys, Mark and Rick might enjoy this for the techie geek side of it. But he's essentially developed his own wireless monitoring device. So he's got he said that you can just pick it up for a few dollars. You can get Bluetooth transmitters that plug into most monitors and anesthetic machines and then essentially just give you a data feed. Obviously, he programmed his own, but you can then just develop an app which will display all the data coming through from monitors, and you can put that onto your smartphone. He even showed how he puts it into the sort of navigation display in his very expensive Mercedes. I'm not too sure what the value of that was. I think he was just showing off his car. but that's not just one anesthetic geek developing that. There's and I think it's been around for a while, but they recently trialed at the institution I currently work at, the Vineman Core Pulse 3, which is a modular defibrillator and monitoring system that has this very sort of type of technology. So essentially just a Bluetooth connected patient module. So all the so obviously you still have the same monitors in the traditional way, so ECG, pulse ox, capnography, whatever else attached to the patient. But it's got a module that just stays with the patient, and then it's got a detachable touch screen that you can take off the monitor. So if you're transferring a patient, the cables all stay on the patient and makes it easy to move them around. Mm. If you're taking them to CT, you can just attach the flat screen that sort of displays the data and just take that into the control room with you. But basically just makes life a lot easier for those types of patients, specifically. And I'm hoping that it is the way of the future in terms of how we do monitoring.
Could you imagine how awesome that would be if you needed to take over, if you're handing over a patient on a transfer, you're handing over a patient or you're taking over a patient in theatre, and you literally just walk in and take that patient's monitoring onto your Bluetooth phone. So you can then just sort of sit there or just but transfer the information, the monitoring and the history of the monitoring between two wireless devices. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I mean that's what this guy from Sydney was doing, and he showed us how. So he just had everything displayed on the monitor, and his iPhone was just like a slave monitor and had all the same sort of real. I mean the lag is a couple of milliseconds, and he had a whole sort of entidal trace arterial waveform all just displayed on his iPhone. And then on the iPad, he would have it in a small window in the corner, whilst he was reading a journal in the main part of the screen.
That's very cool. Does raise questions about why you would have it in your car, though.
Yeah, no, I still can't figure that out. Really, I think he was just showing how well. I mean, his point was that the technology is available pretty much everywhere. I mean, the only thing that he had to purchase was a sort of Bluetooth transmitter. He says that anything with a video display and a Bluetooth antenna, you can get to display this kind of system.
You could think of ways that might be used in an ambulance. So,
well, that's true. Yeah, that's very true. Cool. Well, thank you very much for that, Frank. And back to badly needing a jingle. So, on to our main article, and it's me up this month, and I'm going to be talking about the Proceiver trial. Obviously, you guys have read the article I sent around from NEJM, which I'm pleased to say, actually, my Athens Open Access, my NHS Athens Open Access did actually get me this article, which was awesome, so thank you very much, NHS Open Athens. Were you guys aware of this before I sent the article around?
This particular article?
Yeah.
No.
It's interesting because we this article, which I'm going to go on to talk about in a second, is big news in critical care, and I was actually just going to apologise for the fact we've not managed to cover it because it was actually released in June, I think. That was when we were taking our summer holidays, and now we're on this one article month gig for the new format, so we've not managed to cover it yet. But this is probably one of the most important papers in critical care in the last few years, or certainly this year, I would suggest, without starting too much of a flame war. So, the Proceiver trial was about prone positioning in severe acute respiratory distress syndrome. Now, I'll just start by saying, when you talk about evidence base in intensive care, and I've heard quite a few notable academics talk on this subject, there is very little evidence base for, or there's very little positive evidence base for many of the interventions we actually practice, especially with respect to outcomes. However, one of the big pieces of outcome evidence we do have is from the 2000 ARDSnet trial, which was the original low tidal volumes in ARDS showing a significant outcome benefit on mortality. And this is an absolute classic paper that anyone who's doing ICU or critical care needs to know. And interestingly, very, very recently, there's been papers showing, in fact, there's probably going to be outcome difference if you ventilate everybody on low tidal volumes, including, I think it was done on patients undergoing abdominal surgery in theatre. But that kind of outcome evidence is fairly sparse in the world of critical care, and there's lots of reasons for that, which we won't go into now. However, what did they do in this paper, and what was different about it? There have been many, many different interventions tried for ARDS, which, for those of you who are not familiar with the figures, has a mortality of around about, I think, 30 to 50%, depending on how you classify it and where in the world you are. But we've tried all sorts of wacky things. Ventilation-wise, there's the low tidal volumes, which we know works. High-frequency oscillation therapy has just been shown not to work. There's ECMO trials going underway. We've got surfactants, inhaled prostacycline, beta agonists, N-acylcysteine, omega-3 fatty acids, you name it. We've probably tried it for ARDS, and research has always been equivocal or negative. So the critical care community for ages has needed something progressing on from low tidal volumes to help treat it. Now, proning is something that there's been a lot of interest in for a while. Lung physiology would suggest that, in fact, proning patients will lead to better oxygenation, especially when you've got the kind of restrictive ventilatory defect that you have in ARDS. The randomized controls that have been done to date have failed to show any difference in outcome. And in fact, there's been lots of suggestions of an increase in complication rate from actually turning these patients, or requirements for specialist equipment. So, what was different about this study? It was a multi-centered randomized trial in France involving 26 ICUs in France and one in Spain. It included patients with early and severe ARDS. So for the definition of ARDS is something that's been, there's a lot of contention about, and recently the criteria which most people will be familiar with, which are the European American Consensus Conference criteria, have been updated to the new Berlin definition. And in fact, I'll just do a quick plug for this. There's a BJA podcast which I did with Stephen Frulich, who's doing a PhD on ARDS. And in fact, that's not about the PROCEVA trial. It's about the difficulties with getting an adequate definition, and without having an adequate definition, how you actually go on to design proper studies to investigate something, and the problems surrounding that. But for the purposes of this, they were taking patients with severe ARDS, so that was a PF ratio of less than 150 millimeters of mercury, or converting that into SI units is less than 20 kilopascals, an FiO2 of greater than 0.6, and a PEEP of greater than 5 centimeters of water. Once patients reached these criteria, they had to be randomized within 36 hours, and then significantly they went through a period of stabilization, which was 12 to 24 hours, to confirm the severity essentially of their ARDS, make sure that it wasn't just a blip or they weren't going to suddenly get better, confirm that this was ARDS that was severe and had set in for a while. They then randomized to one of two arms, prone or non-prone, and the study went forward. Now, the intervention with the proning is quite interesting. The proning was conducted for at least 16 consecutive hours a day. So they weren't just flipped and just left like that. They were flipped for 16 hours minimum, with their head being turned from side to side every 2 hours. And proning was stopped, as in the daily proning, once they met criteria of a better PF ratio, so better than 20 kilopascals, a PEEP of less than 10, and FiO2 of 0.6, and they went back to normal supine care. Two things are particularly of note here. Number one is that they didn't use any special equipment to do this. This was proning done on a completely standard ICU bed. And secondly, and probably the most significant criticism of this study, is that all of the ICUs involved had significant experience in proning. They'd all been doing it for more than 5 years. There's a particularly good video, which we'll put a link to, on Needham, which is a little instructional video showing you how to prone a patient with, I think they use three staff, and it's quite impressive the way they do it, but quickly, effectively, and safely, which is certainly the biggest concern that I've come across when you suggest proning patients on ICUs, but we'll talk about that a little bit at the end. So what were the results? These are the really interesting bits. So they randomized 466 patients to either a supine or a prone position. Most of the patients had ARDS due to pneumonia, most were on vasopressors, and most were on a significant number were having neuromuscular blockade. Now, this is the big news. Prone positioning significantly reduced 28-day all-cause mortality compared to supine positioning from 32.8% down to 16%. So that's a reduction in 28-day mortality of 50%, which is massive. I'll remind you, the ARDSnet trial was a reduction in 28-day mortality from 40% to 31%, but we're looking at 32.8 as the baseline, bearing in mind this is 10 years after ARDSnet and treatments generally got a bit better, but down to 16% with a number needed to treat of 6, which is better than shark attacks, which is my current gold standard. This is enormous news for the intensive care community, absolutely huge. And in fact, the reduction in 90-day mortality was from 41% down to 23.6%, so nearly the same degree. The trial was actually powered for a 28-day mortality of 60% in the control group, but in fact, the mortality was 32.8%. But again, these are the sort of trials that normally are criticized for being underpowered, but the effect size was so massive that when you did the post-hoc statistical power calculation, it was 99%, which again is huge news. Now, the big question is, when we've had a couple of at least one randomized controlled trial on proning in the past that's been unsuccessful, why was this trial not only successful, but so overwhelmingly successful? Well, it's partly potentially due to the fact that these units that were involved were quite familiar with doing it, but partly also to do with patient selection. These were patients with severe ARDS who were getting proned. It wasn't just all comers. And secondly, that the proning was done for 16 hours minimum. It was a good long bit of proning, whereas I think a good long session of proning, where I think in the past it's been done for 2 or 3 hours until you see an improvement in the oxygenation and they've been flipped back. So, in summary, massive news for the critical care community. It looks like we might have an effective treatment for ARDS, certainly going to make us rethink once again the way we ventilate patients. And since I'm reading this paper, now I'm suggesting flipping every patient who meets the criteria for this. And I've got to say, the unit where I'm working at the moment, we don't flip patients that often. We do it, but there is a certain resistance to go ahead and get on with it because of the perceived A, difficulties, and B, complications. And I think that probably is a very significant factor you have to include when you make that decision to turn a patient. Anyway, so that's the PERCEIVER trial. I think it's a trial that anyone who's doing ICU needs to know about. ARDS is so very common and also so very lethal. Having an effective treatment in our armamentarium is huge news and a great relief for anyone who comes up against this on a daily basis. Over to you guys.
Can I ask one question? The control group that were staying supine seems to have a much lower mortality rate than they usually do for ARDS. So how did they explain that?
I'm not sure. So they powered it for a mortality rate of 60%, which seems a lot, bearing in mind the ARDSnet trial had a mortality rate of 40%. I've actually done another little bit of research that I'm doing at the moment. It has caused me to look up this figure, and I've done a mini meta-analysis on it, and it seems to be about 45-50%. And again, it's very, very dependent on how you define ARDS or ALI. But in answer to your question, which I'm not adequately answering, I don't know. I suspect it's just, I don't know. I think maybe it's just the fact that these patients are getting good care. It's been 10 years since we did, or 13 years since ARDSnet. I think we're just better at...
better in general.
And also the patients were having low tidal volumes.
But we've discussed studies on a podcast before where just, by seeming to be enrolled in a trial, people seem to do better regardless. maybe you're right. It's just, well, maybe it's better care in general, but maybe it's more particular care when you are involved in a trial.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Mark.
There's some suggestion that I've come across that the baseline levels of each groups weren't equal, and that the people who were prone on this study might have been less sick in the first place.
Yeah, I have. I didn't mention it, partly maybe because that's a little bit of reporting bias. I'm so enthusiastic about the trial, I didn't want to tell you the bad points about it, which is naughty, and I'll slap myself on the wrist. So yes, Mark, you're quite right. The SOFA scores were in fact statistically slightly different, and the patients in the supine group had very marginally lower SOFA scores. However, when you corrected this for this statistically, there was still an enormous treatment benefit. So it does go away and doesn't really detract from it.
Oh, okay.
I do think that probably the most significant the most significant criticism of this study, which you do see time and time again, is that these centres have been proning patients for years. They think it works. They know it works. They're very experienced in doing it. If you look at them on the NEJM video, they're incredibly slick. And so if you look at their complication rate in both the supine, or their sort of iatrogenic complication rate in the supine and the prone group, they're completely equivocal.
Mm.
There's not really any difference. But thank you for picking me up.
They had a surprising number of accidental extubations, I thought, in both groups. Where has it gone? It was like a 10% accidental extubation, even in the people who are the right way up, I think.
I've got to say, that fits with my general observation. I would say patients who are undergoing a significant period of ventilation, I would say 1 in 10 of them have an accidental extubation.
Really? I've hardly ever seen it.
Really?
Yeah.
No, I reckon if you asked me to take a guess, I would have said probably about 1 in 10. People who have ventilated.
Can we just clarify this? Are these ones that you've been responsible for securing the airway?
No. These are ones where I've responded to the crash buzzer, and right. There's been a patient with a tube that is no longer hanging out of their mouth.
Here we go. Adverse events more common with prone positioning included unscheduled extubation, which was 13.3% versus 10.9%. They were both high. 13%, yeah. one in eight. People you're prone are going to lose their tube.
Yeah, that feels...
That's quite scary.
Really?
Yeah.
That feels about right to me. I'm not saying that's a standard you should aim for. I'm just saying my casual observation would agree with that. Doesn't feel unrealistic.
No, it just feels scary.
And of course, when they do, or when something does go awry, we now know how to resuscitate them, thanks to Bex.
Yeah.
So no problems.
No problems.
Fantastic. So that's the PERSEVER trial. All links in the mega notes, including a link to the editorial that was also in that issue. On to the final straight of the podcast and to something I've been very excited about, which is Frank. You are in the ranting hot seat.
Oh, yeah. So are we... sorry, there's no poetry this month, Bex. You'll forgive me.
No, poetry corner, poetry corners.
You won't reach those dizzy heights of greatness, so don't even try.
I couldn't possibly compete after last month's contribution. Are we supposed to stick to a minute?
No, you can rant for as short or as long as you want, really.
Anyway, but slightly over a minute, but yeah. Okay, I'll try my best. Apologies to the high standard Mark has set. But recently, I've occasionally been relegated to the doldrums of anaesthesia, that is, the catheter lab. As most cases last between 4 and 6 hours, there really is not much to do after we've settled in, programmed the pumps, set the alarms, and run out of kit to attach and play with. So this gives me time to actually complete the chart in full intricate detail, even preemptively documenting the sign-out and instructions for recovery. I elegantly give a balanced anaesthetic, do my best to facilitate the procedure for the cardiologists, and ensure that my patient wakes up comfortably and smoothly. We wheel our patient to recovery and I carefully reconnect the monitors, transfer the oxygen, and ensure all observations are normal whilst giving a thorough handover. I point out the neatly written prescription chart, where I've even signed the oxygen prescription and demonstrated my best multimodal approach of anaesthesia and antiemesis. With some satisfaction and a warm smile, I ask the recovery nurse if they are happy with the patient, only to be asked if I can prescribe something for sickness. Horrified, I double-check the prescription chart, but no, I have prescribed not one but two antiemetics, I respond, and that's in addition to the two I've already given in theatres. But the other doctor has always prescribed metoclopramide, it's what's on the pro forma. When choosing from the smorgasbord of antiemetics offered up to me by the hospital pharmacopoeia, I assure you that I've taken a fair bit of time to ponder my choices. Years of training have gone into finessing my choice of drug based on evidence, carefully weighing up indications and contraindications, risks and benefits, efficacy and tolerance. I try and charm and cajole the nurse into seeing my point of view and the benefit of independent thinking and tailoring of treatments. Don't worry, I'm told with an exasperated look. I'll just bleep the cardiology SHO. They can come and prescribe it.
Oh.
Took you down a peg or two from your little consultant time. Love it.
Oh, that is an epic recovery nurse burn up in your face.
Oh, that's poetry.
Oh. Well, Frank, that's excellent. Well, I mean, that's not excellent. That's terrible. that is utterly, utterly appalling. But a very good rant, and one I think we can all... I've lost the word to speak. The word
identify
to speak.
With.
One You've not been can... at the tramadol as well.
Relate.
No. I'm starting to come down from my coffee in KFC high.
All the MSG.
Yeah, and lose what's going on. Bex, it's a day that... I know I've been very much looking forward to. I'm slightly nervous, but I'm very, very excited to see what you're going to do with Biology of Buncombe.
I can't tell you how pleased I am to be on this side of the quiz. It's really, really, really nice. I don't care if it's totally shambolic. At least it puts a halt to my losing streak, which has gone on for 2 years and 3 months. Right.
But you won for the first time last month was the...
oh my God, I forgot!
You actually won. You're here on my spreadsheet of winners. And for the first time, you've appeared in the winner column.
Oh my goodness. I've totally forgotten.
I mean, it's time for you to follow that up with an awesome hosting duty.
I should try.
Okay, all right.
Ready?
I never been so ready.
So welcome to this month's Biology of Buncombe. And as usual, there are three science stories, two of which are true and one of which is Buncombe. Now, I've deviated from Mark's parasite theme from last month, and I've gone with a social sciences theme. So listen closely. Right. Study number one. To date, most studies regarding Facebook users have focused on students. However, a more recent study from Melbourne in Australia has looked at 1,324 internet users aged 18 to 40 and studied the relationship between personality traits and Facebook usage. An online questionnaire package, which comprised of the Narcissistic Personality Inventory, the Revised Cheek and Bust Shyness Scale, and the Social and Emotional Loneliness Scale for adults, was used. The results showed that Facebook usage was highest amongst those who were extroverted, narcissistic, and less conscientious when compared to non-Facebook members. Right, so that's study number one. Study number two. A study from Sydney in Australia has just been published, which explores the role of facial hair in women's perceptions of men's attractiveness, health, masculinity, and parenting abilities. 10 men of European descent were photographed first as clean-shaven, then with 10 days of beard growth, and finally fully bearded after 6 weeks of not shaving. Women judged faces with 10 days' worth of stubble as the most attractive, with clean-shaven or fully bearded equally less attractive. Full-bearded men were rated highest by the woman for parenting ability and healthiness, while masculinity ratings altered according to the phase of the woman's menstrual cycles, attractiveness ratings did not. Okay, ready for study number three?
Mm-hmm.
A recent study from Philadelphia in the United States has explored the relationship between dietary nutrients and unusually short or long sleep duration. Data on 5,587 Americans under the age of 60 was obtained via the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. Short habitual sleep duration is known to be associated with obesity, diabetes, and performance deficits. Long habitual sleep duration is associated with poor physical and mental health. Theobromine, in the form of chocolate, and fast food takeaways were found to be independent risk factors for extremely short sleep duration. Right, those are the three studies. Number one being Facebook, number two being beards, and number three being nutrition and sleep. So let's start with Rick.
Ah, it's a good job. That's a very, very good job. I'm
in awe.
I am in awe. I am in awe. Okay. All right. So I'm going to... The facial hair, that just makes sense to me. I think that's true. Can't really tell you why. You certainly don't want to see me after 6 weeks of not shaving, because that is not a pretty sight. I'm sure that one's correct. The Facebook users being extrovert narcissist kind of intuitively does make sense to me. And any nutritional type research, especially when it's to do with fast food and sleep cycles and all sorts of woolly meh type science, I almost always think is false. So I'm going to go with my gut. I'm going to say the dietary nutrients is the bunkum.
Okay, moving on to Mark.
I will go with the beard one.
Okay, Frank?
Oh, it was an even spread then, because I'm going to go, I think you put them together very well, but I think the Facebook, some of those scales sounded fishy. I think the beard one is probably true, and I think the American one you've either put together very well or is true, because it sounded too official to be made up.
Well, it actually breaks my heart, because I was really hoping to watch Rick fail on a catastrophic level, having handed over the baton of who's designing the studies. But actually, Rick is the winner, and he's right that the nutrition and sleep one is the bunkum.
Science wins.
Well done, you.
So devastated. I was really hoping he'd be so far wrong.
So what's the reasoning behind that? Is it a little bit of truth in a lot of lie?
It's a little bit of truth that they did do the study, and that is how many people they looked at. But basically, if you eat a varied diet, you sleep fine. And if you eat too much vitamin C, you won't ever sleep again.
Really?
How much is too much?
I didn't go that far into it, but it's the one flagship thing they found that was really bad for you to get enough sleep.
Hmm. Cool.
So, well, I'm horrified that Facebook thing is true, though.
Well, I feel quite smug about that, because I don't belong to Facebook, and I'm quite anti-Facebook. And now it's because, obviously, I'm not narcissistic, and I'm conscientious. Love it.
Cool. Well, Bex, thank you very much. That was an awesome job. And I think next month it's going to be back to me. I think we're going to see how weak biology or bunkum's actually been for the last 2 years. So look forward to that. Anyway, hopefully we've got it down to an hour. I think the tweetathon's been reasonable. We've managed to do some tweeting. I see there's a hideous picture of me. Oh, have you taken that down?
I'm just re-putting it back up, because I did it without the hashtag.
Ah, okay. So, yes, so there's a hideous picture of me with some facial hair that Mark's managed to put up. So thank you very much for that.
Fine, from the archives.
Yeah, we might try and storify that. And hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back next month. Thank you very much for listening.